I know we've all missed the debates, so we have one today just sort of to keep up the momentum. We have two great participants who you probably already know. Peter Minnell is the Corrett Professor of Law at UC Berkeley School of Law, as well as co-founder of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology, which, of course, with the counterpart at Stanford, is the force behind this conference every year. After law school, he clerked for Judge Newman of the Second Circuit. He also has been an organizer of dozens of intellectual property education programs at the Judicial Center for almost the last 20 years, so quite a significant contribution there. Chris Palermo is partner at Hickman, Palermo, Becker, and Bingham, and he concentrates in patent and IP licensing risk analysis, and he has extensive experience in an entire waterfront of information technology matters and markets. Gentlemen, please take it away.
The clicker. Thanks. If you can pull up the slides, please. Well, good morning, everyone. We're going to pick up where the last panel left off. We're going to go up about 10 or 20,000 feet in elevation and try to look at how we got to this situation of what I feel is a lot of chaos. I will begin by saying that I got to pick my side of the debate. We didn't flip a coin, and so I feel somewhat at an advantage. But the goal here is not to sort of win a debate. It's to try to elucidate what really is driving this issue that's taking up so much of your effort and the court's efforts. And I see it as a colossal, well-intentioned, but colossal error. And part of the problem of our system is that it's very hard to walk into court and to suggest that any decision, especially decisions of the Supreme Court, could be wrong. But as an academic who has only one client myself, I am free to make those points. So let's begin. So I'm going to spend most of my argument on point one, that I think that the Mayo and Alice decisions are fundamentally flawed, that the Supreme Court did not have adequate briefing to address these issues. We all talk as though the Supreme Court is really dying to figure out the answers to questions about what does abstract mean. I can assure you that that's the least of their concerns. For many years, they ignored, ducked patent cases. They got back into it following the dot-com bubble bursts and all of the NP litigation. And I would say that they've done some fairly useful things. I personally think the eBay decision, the KSR decision, the Nautilus decision, these are sensible decisions. Some stretch some boundaries. But I'm not unhappy with those as a matter of what perhaps is within the Supreme Court's wheelhouse, or at least their ability to interpret statutes. The Mayo case came as just a total shock to me and many others. Many of us had filed briefs in the Bilski case, and we thought that was an opportunity for the Supreme Court perhaps to correct the State Street decision. And we were disappointed that Justice Stevens' decision didn't carry the day. But Justice Kennedy wrote an opinion that pretty much said, the Supreme Court's not going to take a very active role. So when the Mayo case came up, many of us ignored it. And that, I think, is part of the problem. The briefing in the case was really inadequate, and that's what I want to jump into right now. We all are familiar. We just spent an hour talking about what is now the test. Only in the United States is this the test, and this test goes against so much of the history of the patent system. So we ask first whether there's a patent-ineligible subject matter, and I'm not going to say that that isn't relevant to figuring out these questions. But the idea that it's based on a preemption rationale is completely out of character with the whole history of our patent system and prior Supreme Court jurisprudence. We've always understood that preemption is why we have a patent system. We want to exclude competitors for a limited time so as to encourage investment. If there is a patent-ineligible concept, we move on to the second inquiry, and we ask whether there was an inventive concept. We've heard ad nauseum in the last session about what is well understood, routine, and conventional. But we've created a whole sort of parallel structure for how we do 101 analysis. And I'm going to suggest that this is really an invention or a discovery of the Supreme Court that lacks no basis in the history of our system or the Supreme Court's proper role. So one of the things I did after last year's session, I moderated a panel last year touching on some of these issues, and one of the lawyers was from Fish and Richardson. Fish and Richardson represented Mayo in the famous Mayo case, and it's kind of surprising, perhaps shocking, that Fish and Richardson would lead the way to kind of wipe out, you know, most diagnostic patents and a lot of other things. And when I talked to the lawyer afterwards, he says, you know, we didn't argue any of that. That sort of came out of the ether. So I went back and I pulled all the briefs in the Mayo case. Where did the Supreme Court get this from? It's not like they're spending their free time reading patent history. They must get it from the briefs. And so I did find one brief that brought this to the fore. It was filed by someone who I know and like, Josh Sarnoff, a professor. And what did the brief say? Well, the main section that deals with what became the Mayo case is entitled Prior Art Treatment of Excluded Discoveries and Creativity in Their Application Are Longstanding Requirements of the Patent Act. That's interesting. Where did this come from? This notion that we treat discoveries as though they are in the prior art, or algorithms as though they are known, even though we know that they're not. Well, it comes from this passage in the Morse case, O'Reilly versus Morse, the telegraph case, very famous case. And that case referenced Nielsen versus Harford, an old British case. And there's a statement in the Morse case that really parallels what was stated in the Nielsen case. And they say, but after much consideration, it was finally decided that this principle, the principle of preheating air in a hot blast furnace, must be regarded as well known, and the plaintiff had invented a mechanical mode of applying it to furnaces. Well, that does seem to match, you know, the subject heading, prior art treatment. But it turns out the Nielsen case doesn't mean that at all. And that's one of the shocking aspects of this. So let's go back through the time tunnel to the time of O'Reilly versus Morse. And most of the claims in that case were upheld. All kinds of claims to telegraphy were upheld. But as is done today, the prosecutors, you know, let's shoot the moon. Let's go for everything. So in the eighth claim, they said, I propose not to limit myself to any specific implementation, but I claim all uses of electromagnetism for communication. They claimed the internet. And that was the issue that got the Supreme Court's attention. Most of the claims were upheld. And so in that decision, we see the Supreme Court referring back to this famous Nielsen case. They say, we're only going to speak about the important leading cases. And at the front of that group is the Nielsen case. And a lot of the Morse decision is describing the Nielsen case, which involved one of the most important inventions of the Industrial Revolution, the hot blast furnace. This was what enabled the smelting of ores. Because we could improve combustion in the hot blast furnace, we could use lower quality fossil fuels, lower quality coals, and we could achieve much higher temperatures. And so how did they do it? Well, you can see from the diagram, they were injecting air into the furnace. Well, it turns out that injecting air was not new, and it wasn't even claimed here. What was claimed was preheating the air. And that seems kind of obvious if you think about it in a modern mind. Yeah, if you want to get a hotter furnace, why don't you inject hot air rather than cold air? Well, back then, no one knew that. The idea was perhaps cold air might combust even more. Who knows? But Nielsen claimed it, and it was upheld, and the Supreme Court went back and reviewed that case in deciding whether this eighth claim in the telegraph patent was going to be valid. Now, the Supreme Court says, U.S. Supreme Court says, we see nothing in the Nielsen opinion that differs in any degree from familiar principles of patent law. Nielsen was claiming not just the particular apparatus, but he was claiming all apparatuses. He had a very broad claim. And that was really what was troubling to the parties in this case. The defendant had two main issues. They said, first, you didn't sufficiently describe it. There's an enablement problem here. And secondly, that you were claiming the principle and not merely a machine. So those are the two issues. And on the first issue, the jury said, yes, this is enabled, that the description was sufficient because a whole range of apparatus would work, and that was not a basis for rejection. So then we get to the second concern, this idea of the principle, and this is where the key language comes from. And you can see the Supreme Court is quoting verbatim Baron Park's opinion, and they say Baron Park wrote that it was very difficult to distinguish this issue. He goes on to say, after full consideration, we think that the plaintiff does not merely claim a principle, but a machine embodying a principle, and a very valuable one at that. We think the case must be considered as if the principle being well known, the plaintiff had first invented a mode of applying it by a mechanical apparatus to furnaces. That's the quotation that Josh Sarnoff takes to the Supreme Court, and that's what the Supreme Court latches onto in the famous Mayo decision. Now, if you read further, you find that in the O'Reilly versus Morris case, they said that, in fact, this application of that principle was entirely valid. They say that he could have claimed an improvement to the mechanical arrangements, but his patent was supported because he had invented a mechanical apparatus by which a current of hot air instead of cold could be thrown in, and this new method was protected by his patent. So this was not a case where the principle led to invalidation, the claiming of it. Was a case really about whether it's a machine or not, and they said it is a machine, and it's a whole family. It's a genus of machines. And then coming back to Morris's last claim, they say, Professor Morris has not discovered that the electric or galvanic current will always print at a distance. Unlike Nielsen, where every preheating worked, here you're claiming particular machinery, and we will limit you to that way. So you can't claim the result. You have to claim the way. And that, I think, is good law, and that's perhaps what we're seeing in some of this more recent jurisprudence. So the eighth claim was thrown out. So let's go back and say, what should the Supreme Court have thought about? What would I have briefed if I thought the Supreme Court was actually asking a fundamental question in Mayo? We thought it would be a fairly simple, prosaic decision, but instead we get this radical decision. Well, one question I would ask, and I'm surprised Justice Scalia didn't figure that out himself, why do we see the words inventor discovery going back to the very birth of the country? We see the Constitution referring to discoveries, but more importantly, the first Patent Act says inventor discovered, 1793. We get rid of the patent examination process, and we again go with inventor discoverer, and this is a theme throughout history. Now, 1836 was a very important period in our history. Between 1793 and 1836, there was no examination of claims. Thomas Jefferson was too busy running the country. He didn't want to have to examine patents as well. And so we went into the system that really, in some ways, parallels the modern period, at least the dot-com period, because we had a proliferation of low-quality patents, and courts were struggling. And eventually, we get to 1836, and we institute a patent office. And again, we see this discovery, discovered, inventor discovered language. But more importantly, what I found in my archaeology was a Senate report, which is really the main report supporting this act, in which not only we see criticism of the low quality patents for which we need a patent office and an examination process, but we see reference to a modern usage of the word science and Congress's desire to encourage the discovery of science through the patent system. As the senator says, much has been discovered, infinitely more remains unrevealed. The ingenuity of man is exploring a region without limits and delving in a mine whose treasures are exhaustless. Neither are all the mysteries of nature unfolded, nor the mind tired in the pursuit of them. Now, this does not sound like a court that's saying discoveries are unpatentable. In fact, what they're saying is the patent system is really there to help us in this industrial revolution to bring that into a practical world. And that is the key. If you apply a discovery, you don't have to inventively apply it. The discovery itself is the part that the patent system is seeking. We'll take the invention on top of it, but that's a separate patent. I would divide those two, and you get two claims, two patents, not just one. In 1870, we see this language continuing, and then when we get into the early part of the last century, the development of plant patents, we see more legislative material talking about invention and discovery. In fact, a lot of the plant patents, and this was prior to the 52 Act, so it was all revising the same statute, we allowed patents on things from nature. And so there was, I think, a very general understanding that discovering things was worthy of protection so long as you apply it. The 1952 Act takes this a step further. We have Section 103 expressly brought into the statute, non-obviousness, to try to overrule the Kuno engineering flash of genius test. We get definitions talking about invention and discovery. So it really surprises me that none of this was briefed to the Supreme Court, and they interpret the Patent Act to really exclude the whole concept of discovery. Now, the Mayo case brought us into this sort of new understanding that we've now spent a lot of time doing. So I just want to go to the critical passage where we see this major change. I have to say, I credit the first panel for dealing with what the Supreme Court wrought. For me, it's such an untidy mess that, you know, I'm glad I get to live at 10,000 feet. But for those of you who have to work within those definitions, it's very, very hard. But here's the problem. Here's the fly in the ointment. Here's where the Supreme Court gets messed up. Justice Breyer writes, "This court has previously discussed the Nielsen case." Yes, that's true. "The English court concluded that the claim process did more than simply instruct users to use the principle that hot air promotes ignition better than cold, since it explained how the principle could be implemented in an inventive way." Really? Really? I didn't pick that up. And then he quotes that same language that I quoted earlier. That's why I've left it in the yellow block. And you see, he gets that from this idea, "We think the case must be considered as if the principle being well known, the plaintiff had first invented a mode of applying it." Okay, well, was Nielsen's contraption, was it an inventive application of the preheating principle? Well, according to Justice Breyer, it was. He says, "Thus, the claim process included not only a law of nature, but also several unconventional steps, such as inserting the receptacle externally and blowing the air into the furnace." Well, they were blowing air into furnaces long before Nielsen claimed preheating the air. So that was an interesting... So here's what Mayo says. Jeff Lefston, with who I've been working on this, has gone back and pulled all of these records from the Nielsen case. Here's what the Nielsen case says. "The patentee argued that the mode of heating was perfectly well known. It was no discovery of Mr. Nielsen's, because they were trying to deal with an enablement problem. They wanted to say, it's completely well known." They were a little like Sequinom. We were trying to say, we didn't invent how you amplify. We just know that there's a way to detect, you know, fetal DNA. And they say, all of that was perfectly well known. The Supreme Court just didn't do their homework. It turns out, and I credit Jeff Lefston for having sort of told this story so well, the critical sentence in this passage is not, "We think the case must be considered as if the principle being well known." The critical passage is, "We think that the plaintiff does not merely claim a principle, but a machine." That's the issue that the Nielsen Court was dealing with. And the reason they make this later statement is because they were postulating an analogy to an earlier case, the Minter versus Wells case. And they wanted to say, we want to line this up with Minter versus Wells to show that this is a machine and not a principle. So what was Minter about? It was about a Lazy Boy. Okay, so back then, people were claiming things like this. They had a reclining chair. And in Minter, the principle was well known. And the issue is whether this chair was a machine. And they said, yes, it was. So it was the application of a well-known principle, unlike Nielsen. And at the end of this passage, you say, just so as to the hot blast, only the principle is also new. So Justice Breyer, you know, unfortunately didn't have the briefing, they didn't do the site checking, and we wind up with an opinion that's got everyone twisted into a pretzel. So I and Jeff got involved with trying to persuade the Supreme Court to take this case. Most people tried to say to the Supreme Court, oh, your Mayo case is beautiful, but you need to revisit the issue. We just said, you're just wrong, and you need to deal with that fact. Probably not the right way to go. But, you know, this is an important discovery. Now, I know that it might not be novel. I know someone here who represents another party in the case who doesn't think it's a good patent. But I do want to say that the idea that a non-invasive way of detecting fetal DNA is ineligible strikes me as completely ludicrous. That this is a really important goal of our medical technology industry, to try to avoid people having to go through amniocentesis and to be able to figure these issues out in a much simpler, less expensive, and safer way. So as I said, Jeff and I argued this. We didn't prevail. We're kind of bummed about that. And so you should discount my argument if you think I'm just, you know, feeling hurt. But here's the concern. we're living in an age in which we have 60, 70, 80-year-old Supreme Court justices who never took biology and probably have never really understood these issues. Their law clerks are not drawn from the same pool as the Federal Circuit clerks. They really don't know what's going on, and I don't mean to be rude about it, but the briefs weren't there, because no one expected, including the Fish and Richardson lawyers for Mayo, expected the Supreme Court was going to go down this road. And so I see us living in this world in which we're all looking to the Supreme Court as the grand oracle, and yet it lacks the capacity, it lacks the institutional ability to really solve these problems. So I want to come back to an earlier case, the beginning of this era, the Benson case, and many of us think that this wasn't that well reasoned. It was written by Justice Douglas, and he just goes off on preemption and a whole bunch of other ideas that are probably not quite right. But I give him credit, because at the end of the opinion, this is the last paragraph, he says, if these programs are to be patentable, considerable problems are raised, which only committees of Congress can manage. For broad powers of investigation are needed, including hearings which canvass the wide variety of views. The technological problems tendered in the many briefs before us indicate to us that considered action by the Congress is needed. That was the white flag. They wanted Congress to step in. Congress has not stepped in. Now, we kind of got past that era with the Deere case, and we've kind of, but, you know, once State Street went off the rails, we've, you know, the Supreme Court is trying to solve a real problem. But 101 is not the way. What we're doing is pulling in 112, 103. We've got a situation where 101 arguably is higher than 103 as a hurdle. Why do I say that? There was a good point made earlier that unconventional might mean something different than non-obvious. But here's my concern, that under 101 analysis, we treat the algorithm and the law of nature as though they are known. We don't do that in 103 analysis. We're allowed to look at the invention as a whole. And so we've created sort of a backward system. I mean, it's a contraption that doesn't work. We have a lot of smart lawyers who are working on this problem. The PTO is holding roundtables. But I think we should sort of open up this legislative process and ask whether we could do better. There could be simple surgical provisions that would sort of get us back onto protecting these biomedical breakthroughs that are applied. We might even be able to clean up some of the software patent area. But I do think that this is a time where we should look out to see what's going on in the diagnostics industry, what's going on in the software industry. Now, part of my concern is not that the software industry is going to die. Software has a lot of good ways to protect itself. What worries me is we're sort of hiding the ball. We don't allow you to claim the algorithm. But as we just heard from the last panel, that's usually what's being invented. And so if we hide the ball, the claims are going to get really murky, and we're going to get even more problems in how we litigate and how we advise clients about these issues. So I'm not going to say what legislation should be. There are certain proposals emerging. But I do think that we shouldn't treat the Supreme Court as though they know everything. We should use our common sense and move past these issues.
Well, thank you, Professor. That was a superb historical tour of how we reached the result in Mayo and Sequenom. However, I believe that part of the story is flawed by some significant assumptions and omissions. So in the interest of good debate, let me seek to just take us down a notch. You began appropriately with the constitutional clause that has proven so vexing in this debate. Its language, in fact, was suggested in the Constitutional Convention by James Madison. All of us know it well. But right now, we need to focus on one matter that's pretty significant, and that is that it doesn't use the word invention. Instead, Congress is given the power to award inventors exclusive rights for their discoveries. But what did discoveries mean, and why was it used alone in the grant clause? Well, there's a bit of archaeology that was not pursued in the presentation that we just heard. And that is the influence of the French Enlightenment on what the founders knew and how they drafted the Constitution. It turns out that starting in 1751, and why is this automatically running? Sorry about that. It turns out that starting in 1751, French scholars Diderot and D'Alembert published a groundbreaking collection of knowledge titled Encyclopedia. And by the time of its completion in 1772, it had 16 volumes that attempted to collect all knowledge of significance that was then known in the world. In fact, Madison himself cited it in a 1787 article that he wrote outside the constitutional process, so we know that it was in his library. Jefferson also had a copy at Monticello, and so it's not inconceivable to think that the framers had read it. It was the subject of a number of accolades in its time. It was called by later scholars a work that almost became synonymous with the Enlightenment, generally agreed to be the most influential work published in the 18th century and the epitome of the philosophes' achievement. So, a fascinating aspect is how the encyclopedia defined discovery. It's a really remarkable definition. In general, the encyclopedia said that the name discovery can be given to everything that is newly found in the arts and the sciences. However, it is scarcely applied and ought not to be applied except to that which is not only new, but also curious, useful, and difficult to find, and which consequently has a certain degree of importance. The less important discoveries are simply called inventions. Now, so what we find is that at the time of the framing of the Constitution, a discovery had to be that which was difficult to find and had a certain degree of importance. It sounds a lot like a non-obvious apparatus or a process with unconventional steps. This is the sense in which Madison used discoveries in the Constitution. This is why the clause refers to discoveries and not inventions. Inventions were not regarded as important enough. They certainly weren't at the top of the hierarchy. So this historical framework helps us understand why the constitutional clause didn't include the term inventions, but instead used the term discovery. And in fact, what we find is that from the beginning is that Congress was granted the power to award exclusive rights to inventors, but not to those who merely uncovered a natural truth, only to those who had accomplished something curious, difficult to find, and with a degree of importance. So with that background, let's look at some of the omissions of Professors Lefston and Minnell in their brief to Sequenom and why it might have led to the Supreme Court not granting cert in the case. First of all, they don't consider the meaning in 1787 of discoveries at all. Instead, they simply substitute the modern meaning of uncovering and attempt to show that that act alone should be the subject of a patent. All recent scholarship, in fact, on the issue has been almost completely Anglocentric, has not explored the influence of French intellectuals on the meaning of terms in the Constitution. In addition, they don't note that by 50 years later, in 1836, things had changed. The Senate essentially overlooked that meeting in writing the Patent Act that established the Patent Office. And the legislative history from then until 1952 exclusively, and I would say erroneously, substitutes the modern meaning of discovery. In fact, as time goes on in the statutes, the terms get switched, and inventions comes first, and discoveries come second, and eventually discoveries is third. In the listing of things that are appropriate for patenting. So the professors do not even ask whether Congress could exercise its constitutional power within the scope of the original meaning of discoveries, and whether it was correct for the Supreme Court to constrain the law to the scope of the power that was in the Constitution. So the simple fact is that the Mayo Court did not need to engraft an inventiveness requirement to the statutory term discovery, as the brief in Sequenom asserted, because it always had one, based on the meaning of that term at the time of the framing. And finally, the professors don't consider a valid alternate reading of the Nielsen case, which is that the inventor must have known the law of nature, but knowing that, he invented a specific machine to provide it. And such an addition was sufficient beyond mere knowledge of the principle to qualify for patent eligibility, because it transformed the subject of the Nielsen patent into a discovery. So from this standpoint, I would say that the Mayo Court did not misinterpret Nielsen. Now, I don't play a strict constructionist. very often, and so due credit goes to Professor O'Connor, who's the source of the original intent argument that I framed here. And I want to give credit to him, and I believe the professor is familiar with him. So with that, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
2 minutes. Well, thank you very much. I love the archaeology, and I've read and I admire Professor O'Connor's great archaeological work. And I will note that Professor Lefson and I are happy to eat French fries rather than freedom fries. We have no objection to looking into the European experience. But the reality is that the same people who drafted the clause in the Constitution also drafted the 1790 Act. And we've always had this invention discovery dual structure. And even the Mayo case says that Congress has broad authority here, that this isn't a situation where the Constitution is limited. Now, many of the people in this room would be out of business if we went to the version that Professor O'Connor is suggesting, and I would question whether the 1836 legislative history really supports your position, and I think that we've moved well past what might have been part of the young founders' ideals. What happened in 1836 is that people realized that we were living at a time in which the Industrial Revolution was unfolding, and we needed to be improving the quality of patent examination. We needed to have a system that would truly bring out those many science and other inventions. So I'm happy to acknowledge this, but to look at it from a more practical standpoint, that even Justice Scalia, in his wildest dreams, would never go for the form of originalism that was just proposed here. That the idea that we would sort of look at what is in Madison's library as a way of interpreting. And this reminds me a little bit of a recent case involving the song Stairway to Heaven. You might remember this case. But the argument was made that because Jimmy Page had the Spirit album in his collection, that he must have copied it. But I think we can bring a little more insight into these issues. We have several hundred years of experience. And, you know, when I hear what I heard on this first panel about how difficult it is to claim true discoveries that will improve human health, I really think that we are sort of in a bizarre situation where we have to add some inventive application. When the scientists at Stanford and Berkeley are trying to figure out how to diagnose cancer, they typically are looking for those correlations, those laws of nature, and when those can be applied effectively, I think that's where the patent system kicks in. When you come up with a great algorithm, like Karmarkar's linear programming algorithm, and you can solve important technical problems, that's where we ought to focus. And because the Supreme Court has pushed us into inventive applications or ignoring algorithms, we're in this ridiculous system where prosecutors have to, you know, bend over backwards in order to get inventions into our patent system.
I wanted to just go off roll for just a moment and say that I do agree with your suggestion that it would be better to legislatively correct the situation. However, it's been 35 years, I think, since the invitation in Justice Douglas' opinion was given, and nothing's been done. So I wanted to suggest to the audience, especially those who are in-house or in the industry, that the closest thing that we have to legislation in this subject is the USPTO's continuing guidance memorandum, which it is writing, but also providing comment periods for. The number of comments submitted has been relatively small, and I think it would behoove industry to get more actively involved in drafting, in cooperation with the PTO, what the examining guidelines ought to be under the case law as it evolves. It's the nearest we can come to legislation to govern what examiners do, and would go a long way towards rationalizing the application of these cases.
All right, I think we're off. Thank you.
Thank you.